Now we're gonna move to collaboration with the EM community, and Peter is gonna give us a review of what did or did not work in O1, and that will be followed by another panel discussion.
Okay. All right. Well, as I was preparing this talk, I put on the title slide GW Dawn in all uppercase, and it made me think, is this an acronym? Does it stand for something? And I wasn't really sure. But my question about what Dawn really represents for was answered last night when I checked into the hotel. I got the little card. Have a pleasant day, Dawn, your room attendant. So that's why the Dawn meeting here is here, I guess. All right, so I wanted to talk about multi-messenger astronomy. First want to talk about what we did even before O1, and to remind you that multi-messenger astronomy is not all about EM follow-up, although there will be a lot of talk about that because it's complicated. But already before O1, we were doing multi-messenger astronomy in a variety of ways, looking for doing gravitational wave searches in connected with astrophysical events, either in an externally triggered mode where we just kind of take the event information and do a gravitational wave search based on that, or as a joint search where we have some kind of give and take of coordinating triggers, for instance. And we've done that with a combination of publicly available information, like through GCN or other information sources, and privately obtained information that comes through partnerships that we've made, usually guided by an MOU. So that's enabled a bunch of different types of searches of various with various types of possible gravitational wave signatures. And if you, for LVC members, you can go look up our older collaborations proposals page. So in addition, even before O1, we had carried out a limited EM follow-up program. We had about a dozen partner groups, and they actually received alerts and obtained images for several of those event candidates, including the big dog. And then there was the whole range of image analysis results that was published after a lot of work, after a couple of years. And that was one of the things that guided the creation of the new EM follow-up framework, which was kind of carefully and deliberately put together, and I think that was a successful thing. We had enrolled about 74 partner groups with a standardized MOU by the time of going into O1. Okay, so in terms of those externally triggered and joint analyses for O1, I mean, this is ongoing, but just to give you a picture of things, the partnerships that we had created and used in the earlier data have carried forward in many cases. So there's been talk recently and analyses in progress on GRBs, and we're getting IPN lists of GRBs. That's kind of private information. It wasn't not just things thrown over the fence with GCN. With high-energy neutrinos, we've already published a joint search with GW150914 with IceCube and Antares. We have ongoing work with radio transients. I think we have I know an active MOU with the Parkes group, and I'm not sure if we have currently active MOUs with others. For known pulsars, I think we're continuing or to get or arranging to get timing solutions from radio astronomers. And then we have a renewed sub-threshold analysis of Fermi GBM data around the time of GW event candidates. So many of these are continuations of what we've done before, and I've observed that the relationships once built tend to persist. And in some of these cases, even beyond the nominal end of the scope of the MOU, I think some of this work that's going on is carrying forward, even though the MOU that was signed, said it was only for initial LIGO-GRB data or something like that. But apparently there's a common interest in doing this science, and there's a trust that was built up. Even in some cases where the data is available, like say Fermi GBM, it's all public data, but just having that expertise and guidance is considered useful, and so collaborations have continued. So one question we can talk about is how strict should we be about MOUs in O1 and beyond? Should we really be demanding that all of the collaborative work be explicitly written down in MOUs? I mean, so two cases are, when an MOU expires, can we just kind of agree to continue that work, which I think in a couple of cases might be happening now. Another case is that we have partners who signed the standardized EM follow-up MOU, which, you know, we didn't allow for variations on that, but they're also interested in providing their own survey event candidates for X-Trig or joint analysis. And so we're signed partners with them, but not for the scope that they're suggesting we could also use. Anyway, so I think that this is all proceeding nicely from a scientific point of view. A question is whether, from a bureaucratic point of view or organizational point of view, we feel like it needs to be coordinated more formally. Okay, so let me turn to the EM follow-up effort. And like I said, this is not the only thing going on, but this is big and complex. During the 01 run, I think most people know that we sent out three alerts on three event candidates, of which two of them turned out to be quite real, and one turned out to be just noise that was later retracted. But we sent these out to 65 groups, and about 40 groups followed up one or more of these event candidates. So already quite a big response using a variety of instruments. And you've seen the plot with the footprints, the sky map with the footprints on it for the first event. So in this program, what worked and did not work? So I tried to make a list of different topics. For establishing partnerships, I think we have to get some things well. We had criteria for who should be eligible, and most of the groups that applied, we had a lot of applications, most of the groups that applied were in fact eligible, and apparently not too many groups were scared away by the MOUs that we said they had to sign. So that's good. There were some kind of technical complaints that the registration system, babysitting to get people registered and so on. One thing that we did fail to do was to really take advantage of the investment in enrolling people to have a forum with a catalog and continuing. So we set up this, we registered people, we set things up, but we didn't communicate regularly with the full group and kind of keep an ongoing collaboration. But we didn't have occasional communications, which tended to be cold and informal in some cases there. So that's something we could do better. Communication system that we had with the GCN notices and circulars, there was extra sign-up steps. So it was that kind of a little confusing that if you wanted to receive GCN notices. And
what is GCN?
GCN is the Gamma Ray Coordinates Network. So that's the GRE system that we're piggybacking on with a private distribution group. And actually enrolling takes some manual work on the part of Scott Bartleman, who keeps that system going. All right, so I would say, though, that overall, many things worked. Most of the active partners are set up now, but there is still manual intervention needed to keep to do transactions with the registration system and GCN distribution. We are trying to now do a better job of communicating with the forum and having regular teleconferences that all of the partner groups are invited to participate in, and so on. So I think that's working better. In terms of identifying gravitational wave candidates, the low latency analyses worked well and reported triggers, and we felt we understood those triggers pretty well, and we had a good response of people to react quickly when there was a candidate and check data quality and so on. And we rejected quite a few triggers that as junk. We got pretty good at that, better than I thought we would be. So those were good things. All right, as we know, binary black holes had not been included in the low latency analysis early on because the focus was on things that we felt more confidently would be have EM counterparts. But I think then we've learned that there's value in identifying events in low latency, whether or not you expect that. Also, we didn't have the GCN retraction notice mechanism that we had hoped to have. We didn't use that during O1. It meant that, we could still, of course, retract an event by sending out a circular, but that was relying on humans to interpret that. So we didn't have a fast retraction system. We are re-implementing the software to be more robust to identify the gravitational wave candidates and to kind of do the bookkeeping of the candidates we have. We would like to minimize the latency that comes from the human role in vetting these triggers. There are a couple ways we can do that, but one of them that I think is quite natural is a step at some point to not wait for the human to send out that initial alert. Of course, the human then can be examining the data, and if they find a problem, push the button and retract it. But at least the initial alert would go out. That depends on getting this retraction mechanism fully tested. For communicating about candidates, the communication through the GCN system worked pretty well. The access that we provided to partners to our database, GraceDB, worked pretty well, and then returning information about observations using the bulletin board system, it worked pretty well. We collected the kind of a record of observations. As we all know, the alerts were delayed by up to 1 or 2 days. That was just, starting the experience of starting this process, and we had to seek approvals, especially for the first one, but then there were also special cases for the other events. So that was not so good, but only some follow-up observations are counting on fast response. For others, there's not as much time pressure. There are some additional initial technical issues, but that's not such a big deal. A big theme is that we have these concerns about secrecy, and that was part of the reason that we had delays in having to discuss the initial approvals, but especially in getting the additional information out that we had internally about the event candidates, what the nature of the event candidates were, what the significance was, and so on. We didn't get that information out to partners until much later, and that actually was costly in the sense that then they did observing, which was not as wise or not as optimal, having missed that information, and has led to feelings of distrust or not distrust, but disappointment with not being treated as full partners in this effort. So we recognize that, and this is one thing that we're trying to do better. So in the Outlook part, we're planning to provide information about the masses of the event candidates in the case of a binary, to the extent we know that, also about distance. So the approach we're taking is that we're trying to provide digested, interpreted information, but we're trying to provide what is most useful to the observers for planning their observations. For that and for other communications, we should agree on what the guidelines are and then just be able to act on that and not have to go through approval stages. So hopefully we'll be able to agree on these things ahead of time. For follow-up observations, I'm constantly impressed that so many observations were made, even for that first event candidate, even with the caveats that we clearly stated at the beginning about how it happened before the official start of the run and calibration was not finalized, although in hindsight we know that we had good measurements of the calibration. But with all of that and without a clear picture of the significance of that event until much later, the observers really followed up in great detail that first event candidate that was the event. And also, it was really nice to see that most of the astronomy groups willingly shared information about their observations, as we had asked them to do. So there was an undercurrent of, I don't know how much active coordination, but at least some openness about what observations were being done within the community, the internal community. So what was not good about the observations? Well, the astronomers can talk in detail, about their own assessment of that. One thing I pulled up here was that at the GWPAW meeting a couple weeks ago, Ida Berger talked about his assessment of what the observations, how effective the observations had been, and so on, and called out some shortcomings, in particular that many of the observations have not reached the depth that would be needed to find an expected signal. And in some cases, the coverage was not great. Part of that was because the sky maps were large, and the different maps over time were, there was a shift between the burst maps and the CBC maps. So just things to keep in mind for future observing campaigns. I'm sure that the observers are thinking about these things and maybe be more strategic in the future, and also maybe more selective about what event candidates they follow up, especially if we start getting lots of events, once we've had lots of event candidates. For findings from the observations, I think it was really great that the astronomers did take the data seriously and analyzed it, and in many cases have published papers to present that. There's some interesting things being reported that in the papers, even if they're not related to our gravitational wave event candidates, that counterparts were considered. In many cases, spectroscopy was done to classify them, and then they were in most cases dismissed as being too far away. That includes this GBM weak transient in the data was published and is now being debated in the community. It is not dead, despite some claims to the contrary from other people that there was a good give and take on this optical transient PS15 DPN found by PanSTARRS that was temporarily coincident with GW151226. And one of the things I'm glad that we did, and it's the first step that I hope that we can continue, is that we, the LVC, took their sky position of that optical transient and did an actual follow-up of analysis of our gravitational wave data to use that position constraint and do a parameter estimation to find the redshift posterior. And what we found really firmly established that the redshift that they measured was inconsistent with the distance that we measured from our data. We established a partner paper check process to give a relatively quick look over papers that were being prepared for publication to make sure that what they said about the gravitational wave event candidate was accurate and correctly referenced and so on. And we got that going, although for the first round of papers back in February, we were kind of too busy to quickly reply to those, and some of them languished a couple of extra days. And the GCN circulars that were formerly private have been added to the public archive, so the record is there now of what was done internally, what information was exchanged internally, and that happened smoothly. One question that I have is that in the future, will there be occasions when we, the gravitational wave community and the astronomers, will want to do actual joint analyses and publish joint papers? I mean, the papers that have been done so far have been separate, and I think that's entirely appropriate that once information is published by, say, about the gravitational wave event, then the observing papers, if they're just using that published information, are separate papers. But there may be cases where we actually want to do some sort of parameter estimation jointly with gravitational wave data and with the EM data, or maybe some population study or something like that. And we should be open to that mode of doing things. And if we're using proprietary data or actual extra work within the collaboration, then it would make sense for those to be joint papers. So we should look for cases where the science would be well served by doing something like that. Okay, and about open alerts, this is a pending issue that we will start issuing open alerts. We had a written policy on this that talks about after we've published a paper or papers about four gravitational wave events, then we'll switch into this mode of releasing high significance alerts to the public. So, you know, this will change the mode by which things happen. So anyone, even the MOU partners that we have, will be free to publish their observations on this event candidate that's been put out, well, this reasonably strong event that's been put out to the public, which will happen long before the gravitational wave analysis is completed and published. So that's probably okay. We just need to recognize that that's going to happen, that people are going to be reporting on the EM observations first. As to when this happens exactly, you know, the written policy says after we've published papers about four gravitational wave events. We don't know at this point when we're going to publish results presenting new events in O2. It'll be, you know, whether it's at the end of the run or late in the run, the first round or something like that. There is a proposal and a general feeling, but not unanimous, that we should just commit to making this transition after O2, before O3. And I think that's more for concreteness than for any technical reason. I mean, I don't think there's a real technical problem with releasing public alerts, but not knowing when that transition happens bothers gravitational wave scientists and observers, many observers to some extent too. There's also been discussion of whether we should try to reserve the first neutron star binary event to be treated privately by the observers who signed MOUs with us, even if at that point the public alerts are active on the basis of the binary black hole events that we've had, that we've published. And, you know, I'm not even sure that we can do that, depending on how we're classifying these things. But that is a question that people are talking about, that, so I put it on the slide. And I think the panel will then that's going to follow this will be talking about how MOUs should evolve and maybe whether we will continue to have MOUs. My guess is that some partners would continue to want an MOU to get those lower threshold event candidates, and others would be happy to only act on the public alerts, but we should have people talk about that. Okay, I have one more slide which just has some links to documents in the DCC or in one case is from this joint teleconference that we had with EM observers. So if you want to look up various talks that have been given about this and slides from those, you can. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
So if you get to Peter's presentations, we can add that. But then we're going to be talking about MOUs, and we're going to hear from the farmers as well. So you know, let's just give it to a couple of questions. So David, and then right.
Yes, very briefly, a comment and a question. The comment is that the first detection was before we had an earth attack and before we started the earth attack. We did very well.
Yeah.
The second alert was also, we had decided after the first detection that we wanted to know internally whether we had malaria at all. But we cannot decide on that at all. We cannot decide on that. Not. So the fact that on Christmas evening we do less than today, less than the first one.
Yeah, I only meant bad in kind of an abstract scientific sense, but obviously we successfully navigated these things.
But the question is, I think you mentioned this, but I haven't heard of any two different groups that might use coordinating their observations.
That's
true. There were no two different groups that coordinated observations.
Well, there were groups that I think had an affinity for working together anyway that were formally different groups in our MOUs. So, other than that, I don't think there was any great degree of coordination.
Okay.
In fact, I have a similar question. It's related to how the thing really gets coordinated by us if it does evolve. In other words, do we have any control or do we make suggestions as to where they should look? We tell them a point, but then we don't say, look, we already know that group A is looking there. Why don't we look at another place to conserve the total amount of intelligence that's out there? How do we orchestrate?
We've deliberately decided not to attempt to do that. We've provided a tool for them and an encouragement to communicate, but we have not attempted to centrally coordinate the observing.
But they have to share whether the region.
That's right. They're asked to report where they have observed or are about to observe in the sky, so that others can take that.
All of them get that information.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. We have Sata and Leon.
Two questions. Astronomers would like to receive binary platforms. By now, that is the stuff.
Yeah.
You're not telling us, oh, don't send me. Okay. Secondly, is there any sort of comment about whether they want more information?
Yeah, can we hear from them? Can we add this after we hear from
them? Oh, we do?
Yeah. Okay.
That would be a good thing to handle.
Oh, yeah. So anything specific for Peter's presentation? So, Pablo?
So you mentioned that Pablo will send set of kind of somehow confusing the cost on issue. Now, this might happen again, either because we have DNS and we have BPA in general, even though those are even not really that different, or because we get more DBHs. We have a plan, you know, the maximum amount of difference from the other because they can handle us.
What?
If we did, okay, to avoid something again.
Do you want to answer that, Leo?
Yeah, sure. I don't know, my voice is rather booming. For MBTA versus GA Wild and for Dragon Sky Maps, we're very disciplined. But we do have a policy that we don't send alerts for both, you know, for multiple buildings, CBC, protecting the same event. The policy is that if we detect an event, more than one Python, the CPC detection is present. I'm not going to say that it's nothing similar is ever going to happen, because as soon as I say that, it's going to happen. But the worst case is that we can have a really interesting binary viable system that's wildly deceptive. So, in that case, fairly dissimilar from the final one, but for events for relatively straightforward, stellar mass having black hole or EMS signals, what happened with the GW or real or not?
Okay, so we actually are lucky enough to have some of our young partners joining us today. So I think I would like to give them the floor now. So with this panel format again, you can talk from your seat or come up here. There are some slides that some of them have. So I think Neil